This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and we're broadcasting from the Cultural District on the Square in Icon Gallery in Fairfield, Iowa, across the globe, streaming along across the internet.
And even right. Being downloaded from icon-art.org.
That's right. You can download the ILR shows from www.icon-art.org. Okay, Donna, take it away.
Well, I've been in the last couple of weeks teaching a class called Discovering the Miracle of Color. And in researching for this class, I've learned a lot more about color than I even knew before, even though color has been my passion for a long time as an artist. And one of the things I came across was a batch of quotes by Kandinsky and Matisse on color that are just spectacular quotes. And so I wanted to read the one that to me is just the most stellar quote of all. It just makes me feel happy every time I hear it. This, and it's a sort of longish quote, but it's worth hearing the whole thing. This is a quote by Kandinsky. He said, "The sun melts all Moscow into one spot, which, like a mad tuba, sets one's whole inside, one's whole soul vibrating. No, this red unity is not the loveliest hour. It is only the final note of the symphony which brings every color to its greatest intensity, which lets, indeed forces all Moscow to resound like the fortissimo of a great orchestra. Pink, lavender, yellow, white, blue, pistachio, green, flame red houses, churches, each an independent song, the raving green grass, the deep murmuring trees, or the snow, singing with a thousand voices, or the allegretto of the bare branches, the red, stiff, silent ring of the Kremlin walls, and above, towering over all like a cry of triumph, like a hallelujah forgetful of itself, the long, white, delicately earnest line of the Ivan Veliky bell tower, and upon its neck, stretched high and taut in eternal longing to the heavens, the golden head of the cupola, which is the Moscow sun amid the golden and colored stars of the other cupolas. To paint this hour, I thought, would be the most impossible and the greatest joy of an artist. These impressions repeated themselves every sunny day. They were a pleasure which shook me to the bottom of my soul, which raised me to ecstasy. And at the same time, they were a torture, because I felt that art in general, and my powers in particular, were far too weak in the face of nature. Many years were to pass before I came to this simple solution, through feeling and thinking, that the aims, and thus the means, of nature and art are essentially, organically, and by universal law, different from each other, and equally great and equally strong. This solution, which today guides my work, which is so simple and utterly natural, does away with the unnecessary torture of the vain task that I had inwardly set myself in spite of its unattainability. It banished this torture, and as a result, my joy in nature and art rose to untroubled heights. Since that time, I have been able to enjoy both these world elements to the full. To this enjoyment is joined a tremendous feeling of thankfulness."
That's great.
It just delighted me in the context of teaching a course on color to have that perspective, because I think as artists, we've all faced that dilemma of whether we're trying to paint nature as in a landscape or we're trying to paint some inner feeling or emotion or something like that, there's that frustration in the translation process. And to look at it the way he finally discovered he could look at it as two completely different things, it resolves that. And to me, the way he did, I mean, because of that last line, the way it seemed to me that he was resolving it was feeling that his gratitude and his appreciation was then expressing itself in his art, that it was an act of homage to what he was loving so much, rather than trying to compete with it or replicate it.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of the direction of the Impressionists. You know, you start expressing your response to it rather than trying to reconstruct it.
I think that he was a pioneer in the unfoldment of the modern movement. Mm-hmm. And I think it began, we've gone mm-hmm. through this, I've talked about this progression from the Renaissance through the Impressionists and into the modern period before, but I think that really things got heated up with the Impressionist movement, mm-hmm. huge change towards, you know, what is to be expressed. And I think that that distinction between the replicating of nature and trying to reproduce all the beauties of nature, and that art had a life of its own, the art for art's sake kind of movement came out of that. But I think Kandinsky and Matisse and those that formed the modern movement at the beginning of the 20th century were really making the case for that it is a world of its own, and it's the same nature expressing itself by the same laws that structured all the beauty around us, but rather than kind of trying to copy how intelligence of nature created all of that, the sunset and the hills and the trees and all of that, celebrating that intelligence as it emerges in man. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this all along. I mean, I found that to be true in gardening.
Yeah.
Planning, you know, what we call it, urban planning, you know, mm-hmm. creating, there's definitely a difference between wild nature and the ordered communities and ordered life of the human world. It's two kind of worlds. And so I think that Kandinsky is talking about discovering the joy of how human intelligence expresses itself. And of course, the big issue here is color. Say more about color.
Well, I want to say more about Kandinsky, which always is related to color because he was just so in love with color. Through his whole career, even though he is credited by many people to being the original abstract artist, he did not like thinking of himself completely as an abstract artist, because for him there was always a connection to nature, even in the last part of his career. In fact, in the later part of his career, it's even more obvious that he was really trying to bring out something that he found in nature outside, you know. To him, there are some other quotes, I don't have those quotes today, but there are some other quotes where he downplayed the whole, the kind of doing abstract exercises to see how one color related to another or one form related to another, like some artists did later on, because he felt like he was a very spiritual man and he wanted to bring out the aspects of nature that lie within and bring those out in his, which you could only do by abstracting the forms that you see in a more concrete world. So his, and you noticed in that quote, his many references to music, and that was one of the aspects of life that Kandinsky really wanted to bring out and celebrate in his paintings. So many of his paintings, especially for this one lengthy period in the middle of his career, had references through color to sound and rhythm and flow and all of these aspects of music that he loved so much. And when you go and see those paintings in a museum, these great big paintings with these beautiful, colorful forms, you really can, in a sense, hear them. There's something that dramatic about, that successful about his attempt to take sound and put it into color and form without it being like some obvious thing, you know, without him using like little musical notes or something. It was there are loud portions, there are percussive portions of the painting. There are andante, adagio, you know, all these musical terms. There are those portions of the painting that you really feel, and it's a whole symphony when you look at it.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you were reading it, I was thinking his musical metaphor was so vivid that it made me wonder if he was a synesthete, if he's one of the people who does experience color as a kind of sound or vice versa. Usually that particular mapping, it turns up among musicians. And they have a completely, you know, stable, established color for every pitch on the in their musical world, to the point where if the pitch is off a little, the color is off noticeably. So they can tune their instruments by the color of the sound.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's totally wonderful. Wow. I'm very jealous of people who have that experience. And it was it went undocumented for a long time. It was mentioned, you know, occasionally by people, but it was never taken seriously until the 60s. Because people assumed that, the synesthetes assumed everybody saw colors with sounds, and the people who didn't assumed nobody did. And when people talked about it, if you didn't have that experience, which is the majority, you assumed they're being metaphorical. And so it wasn't considered to be anything other than perhaps a very rare and odd, you know, erroneous crossover of the wiring in the brain. Now it appears to be very common. And in fact, in cultures where the language is highly inflected, like Chinese, I think I may have mentioned this previously, very young children are likely to be to have absolute pitch.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
And synesthesia, visual synesthesia, or color sound synesthesia is very common among people with absolute pitch, or fairly common.
Now, one thing I found interesting, which I read in a book recently about color, was that people with synesthesia don't necessarily see the same, like from one person to another, they don't necessarily see the same color.
No, there's no consistency.
Oh, there isn't.
No, it's not like middle C is always blue. Each synesthete will see the way they happen to.
I must have a subtle value of that, because I associate different qualities of the senses with a sound.
Absolutely. There's probably a lot more synesthesia going on than we give it credit.
I just thought that synesthesia had to do with everyone seeing the yellow with a particular note.
No, it's all different. Some sound color synesthetes don't see individual pitch in terms of color. They see intervals in terms of color. So they see, if you play middle C, they see nothing. There's no color. But if you play a whole tone interval, C and D, then they see a particular color.
Played together?
Oh. Yeah.
And the color represents the interval.
The color represents the interval, not the individual pitches. So if they play, you know, an A and a B, they see the same color as C and D. And C and E flat, you know, the minor third is the same as, you know, G and B flat.
Wow.
It's really quite wonderful. And the thing is, it's not symptomatic of anything, you know, other than, as far as we can tell, normal physiology. It's probably more a matter of conditioning that we lose that connection by focusing so much on relative pitch. Because our language is not highly inflected, and all we need to know is whether there's a slight rise in pitch at the end of a sentence to make it an interrogative, whereas in Chinese it's critical throughout the entire sentence.
Yeah.
It's part of the syntax. And as a result, people who speak Chinese have a higher frequency of absolute pitch.
So what is it when you see a pattern associated with a sound? I've had that experience when my eyes are closed and there'll be some sudden noise, that there'll be like a pattern of lots of little triangles or something like that, some little geometric pattern inside my head that seems to be related to that noise, because that it can, if the noise is a repetitive noise, that couldn't even be a pattern that keeps repeating.
Well, you know, it varies. So in some cases, people, it's just you know, evoking a kind of visual imagery. If it sounds like something scraping, then you might imagine something metal. But on the other hand, it could also be a synesthetic experience where there's certain kinds of visual, you know, elements in your visual recognition machinery that get, you know, triggered or stimulated in some way from certain sounds. The brain handles all of this stuff on a massively associative basis, where anything is connected to other things by many different paths. So instead of looking a word up by its first letter, the brain looks the word up by, you know, 1,000 associations with that word. And that's why later in life, when you can't remember certain things, you go back, you ask, you know, the guy in the basement who gets your information for you, you know, you ask him for the word for something or other that you haven't used in a million years, and by now you may have so many random associations with that word that in a sense he has nothing to go on. So he's got to go in there and match a dozen associations at a time with all the different things that might fulfill that request until he finally finds it. And often that's, you know, the next day. And you think, God, my memory's going. But it isn't necessarily related to the acuity of your memory.
Yeah, it just takes longer.
It's just the guy's got more stuff in the vault to sift through the older you get. And a lot of the associations have become very, very complex.
Interesting. Well, that's reassuring.
There's a lot of...
It feels like that's what's going on.
I mean, I have this vivid image of this old guy in the basement of my mind, you know, where all the vaults are and all these, you know, file cabinets and closets and stuff. And, you know, I'm inquisitive and I'm always putting things together and thinking about stuff and trying to relate things to other things. So he's dealing with this continuous onslaught of relatively, you know, random, unpredictable kinds of demands for information out of my past. And I just see this guy, you know, running around, tearing his hair out. Say, all right, I'll find that. I can't, hold on. Oh, now he wants to know the name of the guy who sat next to him in fourth grade. Sure, we've got that, you know. And eventually he gets it, and then he pulls the rope, and the bell rings, and it pops up in my little pneumatic chute in the behind
and
my
yet
eyeballs.
It's so fascinating when we're not looking for those pieces of information. We haven't, you know, put in a request to the little man in the basement, but we just happen to, somebody says something, or even it can come from a smell, or come from anything, like in, you know, Proust, of course, was a master at describing that phenomenon, but it's remarkable how you can have a memory of something that happened 40 or 50 years ago that just like immediately pops into your head. You haven't thought about it in all those years, and it's there completely vividly.
But something set it off. Something.
Yeah, something
sets it off.
Some little
anybody's
sensory
guess.
Trigger.
Well, you know, when you mentioned smell, smell really does have an unusual power to evoke place and situation and context and stuff without necessarily the specifics of it. And it's thought that that's because the rhinoencephalon, which is the portion of the brain that handles smell, rhino, of course, you know, meaning nose, it's pretty much the oldest or one of the oldest parts of the brain. You know, evolutionarily speaking. So it has this, you know, kind of primordial connection to things, and if there's a smell associated with a certain range of experience, you can go 40 years without having that experience and or noticing that smell. And if you then suddenly are exposed to the smell, it takes you right back.
Yeah, there was like when I was in seventh grade, I had a sewing box in school. We had sewing in school in seventh grade. And my sewing box, for some inexplicable reason, had a certain smell that I liked, but I had no idea what made that smell in the sewing box. And about three or four times during my life, I've smelled that smell. Yeah. And each time I smelled it, I didn't know what it was. Like, it wasn't something I could relate to anything familiar. But every time I would smell it, it was like, oh, my seventh grade sewing box.
It's important, yeah.
It's just that unique smell in the universe.
I remember, now that you mention it, the smell of my aunt's sewing box. It was one of these ones that stood on the floor next to her chair. And I think it was made out of the same kind of aromatic, you know, boxwood or something that they make cigar boxes, or in those days they made cigar boxes out of.
Maybe it was the same
smell. It was a very distinctive smell. Yeah, it might well have been. And there's a smell of New York City in the spring. There's a certain smell that the city gets. And if I smell that anywhere else on Earth, it just instantly recreates Manhattan Island for me. It's really powerful.
Well, just when you actually said, before you said in the spring, and you just said there's a smell to New York City, when you said that, the memory of the smell of New York City immediately flooded, and I could smell New York City.
Yeah, well, I was smelling the sewing box a minute ago.
Yeah.
It's a bi-directional hookup there. It's very interesting.
Well, and countries have different smells.
Experience
that.
Which is why when you watch a movie or see pictures of some foreign country and you think, or read about it, and you think you're really experiencing what it's like to be there, and then you go to that country, you're absolutely shocked at how far from the real experience was when you, because mainly it was visual that you were contacting, and when you actually get to the country, like you said, there are the smells of the country, there's the feel of the air and the sounds of the country that you may get from a film, but it's always fuller and richer when you're actually there. It's just really tremendous.
I remember after listening to a radio program starring Eve Arden called Armes Brooks.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened, when I was a kid, I listened to that a lot. It was one of the ones that I could relate to. And then later on, much, much later on, they made a TV show out of it, and Eve Arden, the star of the radio program, starred in the TV show, which often wasn't the case. And I remember seeing her for the first time and thinking, that's not Armes Brooks, that's somebody else, And then I adapted to it, and now when I hear the old radio programs, it sounds correct.
Her. Yeah, right. Well, it's the same thing for me when I saw the Lord of the Rings movie, because I had read the Lord of the Rings trilogy four times when, I was in my 20s. And so each character was very distinct in my mind. And the hobbits in the movie weren't that far off from the way I imagined them, but the character Aragorn was completely different from my Aragorn. And I was madly in love with the character Aragorn in Lord of the Rings. And I almost couldn't watch the movies because the Aragorn was just so off, according to my imagination.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the beauties of books, is that there's a lot of room for us to fill in the entire visual and create our own world of it.
Yeah.
And that's why movies are so disappointing sometimes, because no matter how good it is, because The Lord of the Rings, I think, did a pretty good job of reproducing the quality and the character and the feeling of the book. But and I think that we are all a little bit accessing a universal place. I think we're actually... The books will often set off a mythic reality, where there's some universal crossovers. And the nice thing about books is it sort of allows that to take place.
Well, and in The Lord of the Rings, I think one of the mythic elements in the books is the length of the journey. You know, all of those passages of the long, long, tedious journey, which they didn't do in the movie because, you know, they had to focus on the action segments in the movie, and it was long enough without these lengthy travel portions. But to me, that was an essential element of that mm-hmm. story, was this long, long.
Well, I'm going to bring things back to where we started because mm-hmm. we're almost out of time. I feel that I don't think there's any works of art that I'm familiar with that so seem to evoke the visual nature of music as Kandinsky's painting. I just want to get this in because I didn't get a chance to say it earlier. Mm-hmm. But the visuals and the color, there's sort of visual patterns, as you talked about, that you'll get from music. And I think there was something going on with him along mm-hmm. those lines.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he may well have been a synesthete.
Yeah.
It's too bad he couldn't have motion, or he could have said
oh,
it better.
Right. You know. Been a filmmaker, yeah. Well,
because there's a rippling thing with the visuals that go with music, you know, a rippling patterning.
And his color theory that he, you know, in his book concerning the spiritual and art is very intuitive. It's not formulaic, you know. It definitely has to do with his particular feelings with reference to each color. And when he used those in paintings, whether it was kind of to represent something in music or anything else, to him it was a very real thing that when you put yellow next to blue, this happens, you know, and it's going to be a language that's going to make that happen in the viewer as well.
And I think it's a language. I think yellow and blue next to each other have a meaning. Mm-hmm. It means that. Yellow and blue, and that carries to the audience. Mm-hmm. Green and yellow next to each other.
Yeah,
there's a meaning to that.
Mm-hmm. And he gave gender. He gave colors genders too. Some of them were masculine, and some were feminine. Some were earthly. Some were spiritual, and they all worked together.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.